My name is Van Christou. I have fun doing a little photography. And in my little field of photography, buying cameras, I'm referring now to the technology. I have to rebuy cameras every 6 months now just to keep up with the speed at which these things are being developed. You kind of shied away, I felt, in your talk about how much this is going to cost us. I think it's going to cost us billions of dollars, and I think maintaining it's going to cost us even more, because every new weapon that comes up, it's going to require redoing your entire system. How do you reply to that?
Well, I just don't know how much it's going to cost, and I wasn't skipping around it. I don't know, period. It's pure and simple ignorance, nothing more than that on my part. But I don't know that there are very many people in this country who can tell you. I think that the any answer that is given is politically motivated. And I could say it's not going to cost you very much because I'm in favor of it. And other people will tell you it's going to cost trillions and zillions of dollars because they're against it. But I don't know how you can figure it, because right now we don't know what part we would be playing in a system over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 years. We don't know. We simply don't know. From the slide that I put up on the board, the way that it is being discussed today, there is no actual role for Canada to play. We're not being asked to put interceptor missiles on our territory, and we're not being asked to put sensors or radar detectors on our territory either. But that might happen. So I think I'm being at least honest by saying it's kind of an open book, but I don't know how much it would be. And I don't think anybody does. But will it be costly? Well, everything is costly today. You know, you probably remember as well as I do when the $100 deductible on the car insurance was pretty well what everybody did. Today, I got a $1,000 deductible on my car. Hell, if I do my bumper, it's $2,000. Once upon a time, I bought a car for $2,000.
My name's Andy Davies. I'm a new resident to Lethbridge, a university student. I should say, first of all, I found the blatant partisanship in your PowerPoint sort of disappointing and not very thoughtful. The vilification of the two parties and the happy, smiley photo of Harper was fairly see-through. But to move on from that, there's two things that I have issue with. One is the way you pitched that we should sell this to Canadians, you know, we just didn't sell it right. That sort of corporate speak, I think, is entirely retrograde, especially in something as important as this, especially in a time where the actual threats are coming from are less and less this, and more, I mean, we went through 50 years of the, 50 years roughly, I mean, 40 years of the Cold War, where this may have been the real threat. To put in all of this money, to put in all of actually to shift our priorities and our values to this end, I think is to buy into a great deal of fear and harum scarum, and not much more. I think in terms of empirical evidence for something like you were saying, oh, we don't know what Canada's role would be, how much it would cost, that sort of thing. What we do know is that in terms of diplomacy, in terms of relations with the different nations that are would be attackers, that this likely won't be the solution anyways. What we do stand, we stand... We stand a good chance of antagonizing these nations more than creating anything. My question is, why would we try and sell this against Canadian values? And, I'll go with that.
Why do we want to antagonize these nations? And why would we try to do this against Canadian values? Those are the two questions? Okay. I don't know what more we can do to antagonize Iran than the mere fact that we exist. And the simple fact is that there are... you had your choice. You had your time. Now it's my time. Okay? So what I'm trying to say is you asked why we would try to antagonize... I don't think President Ahmadinejad and the people in Iran who are trying to develop offensive missiles and weapons of mass destruction capability are doing it because we have antagonized them or because we have decided to defend ourselves. Okay, so I think your premise is completely wrong. That's number one. Number two, What Canadian value are we violating by deciding that we want to defend ourselves? I ask you that in return, so you can answer that.
I think shift of values from diplomacy and addressing of social injustice and inequities between these nations as being a higher value and a higher priority than missile defense.
So let me ask you this. Can't we both try to defend ourselves on the one hand and also try to help those third world countries like Afghanistan which need our help and want it? On the other hand, why is this an either-or situation?
I think it's more a question of the amount of priority we put on it, a sort of a first, second, third, where this is on the list.
According to the Polaris Institute, which you would probably be much more favorably disposed to than you are towards, let's say, the kind of institute that I represent, we have spent $4.3 billion in Afghanistan since 2001. I can tell you, $4.3 billion in Afghanistan, we have spent zero on missile defense. So there's your answer.
Bob Tarlick, if I have one question, and that is, a few minutes ago you made the observation that you thought that Prime Minister Mulroney made the right decision when he didn't join in with Star Wars, but you are suggesting that this might be an appropriate time for us to jump into missile defense. What are the key fundamental changes in Canada-U.S. relationships and relationships with other nations that would cause a shift in policy at this point?
Well, I think we've got a different situation. One is that this is a system than the Star Wars system. I think the Star Wars system was simply dreaming. I mean, to think that you could somehow replace mutually assured destruction as a defensive policy, and let's face it, it was a policy that terrorized all of us, but it worked. And to sort of say, okay, we're now going to move beyond mutually assured destruction and try to devise a capability where we'll be able to defend ourselves against your attacking us, was a destabilizing measure. The system that we're talking about today is not a global destabilizing measure. The Russians had no problem with the abrogation of the treaty because they know that the treaty is not aimed at their nuclear capability. The Chinese had no problem. They know it's not aimed at their nuclear capability. So the systems are very, very different systems. Their aims are different, and the possibilities that they will someday be able to produce technological success are also different. The second thing is that in the Mulroney case, the government, I think, was very much of a mind to be helpful fixer with regard to the United States on a lot of international issues and gained the respect of the administration on a lot of international issues. And the fact that Canada bowed out of Star Wars, I don't think hurt the Canada-U.S. relationship whatsoever. I put the decision that was made last year within the larger context of Canada-U.S. relations as it evolved under the Chrétien administration. And yeah, I am partisan, by the way, sir. I'm very partisan. I'm really think that Mr. Chrétien tried to destroy Canada's defense capability and make Canada into a neutral country. Okay, so that was my view on him, and I haven't changed it. And I think Mr. Martin, to his discredit, said that he was going to change things, but he didn't when he got in. So I'm admittedly partisan. And that's another reason, and that is that I think that given the record of the Liberal government with regard to increasing anti-Americanism in this country, that decision was a very unfortunate decision at that time, especially since Mr. Martin had pledged only a couple months earlier to improve Canada's relations with the United States.
I'm Trevor Page. Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. Missile defense has been on our agenda. That's SACPA. We don't think we're going to put our shield up, but I think you have outlined many of the particular issues that were raised in the notice for this session. And I recognize that your talk has been on missile defense. We asked for it. But perhaps you could put that in the perspective of Canada's 3D foreign policy. Diplomacy, I personally would hope, is on top. We've spent 60 years since the end of World War II working on that, so that we don't have to use weapons of mass destruction. And development, the other two D's. Defense, perhaps you could put the whole thing into perspective from your perspective on where you think defense falls. My second question is, were there to be, you did mention very quickly the possibility of a Canadian shield, but I don't pay too much credence to that. But in a North American shield, what say would Canada have in terms of their finger on the button? Thank you.
All right. The 3D policy, just to summarize for those of you who may not know what it is, this was issued last April 19th by the last government, and it was in a document called the International Policy Statement, the IPS. And it tried for the very first time, and to its great credit, I have to say, since the end of the Cold War, to develop an international policy for Canada that integrated defense policy, diplomacy policy, aid policy, and trade policy, to various degrees of success. But at least the government took the approach that everything that Canada does outside its borders is related to some extent. I absolutely agree with that. I think it was precedent-setting and a very good move. So what role does missile defense play in that? It's a part of defense, simple as that. I think, okay, what was your question then?
You put defense into the 3D foreign policy. You're rating it on top of diplomacy and development?
Oh, no.
I mean, don't we sort of try and sort out international problems? Stay here and say, my God, there may be a threat, so we better have the arsenal, but we don't talk? I mean, where is the emphasis? Where's the emphasis got to be?
I think I said that. I certainly never did. Politics in a democracy, politics has got to be the deciding factor in how defenses are deployed. The politicians are the bosses. The civil authority has to be predominant over the military authority, and diplomacy must be the first option all the time. But we have to remember that diplomacy doesn't always work in this world, and that sometimes diplomacy stops and defense begins. That's as simple as that. When we're talking about, if you are referring specifically to the Iranian situation, all power to those who are trying to solve this, short of any kind of military action being taken. I think military action with regard to Iran will be an absolute disaster. But I think it will be an even more disaster if Iran becomes armed with nuclear weapons and the capability of deploying them. So I don't know where that sawoff is going to occur, and I hope that there is a solution to it. As to your second, what was the second question again? Sorry.
If Canada were to go under a North American shield, would Canada have a finger on the trigger?
Well, the trigger will be a defensive trigger. Let's remember that. So someone will decide at some point, if such a system exists and if there is an attack, that the defenses will be deployed. Will Canada have a say in that? I can only hope that our political leaders, whoever they are at the time, are smart enough to make sure that we do have some say, in the same sense that we do in NORAD. And let me say that I think that some of you should know that there was a time when Canada contributed probably 35-40% of NORAD's available assets. And as a result of that, Canada had a virtual 50% say in everything that NORAD did. Many of you are probably aware of the fact that on September 11, 2001, the deputy commander of NORAD was in the seat because the commander wasn't there. And the deputy commander of NORAD, who was always a Canadian officer, made the decisions to ground all air traffic in Canada with consultation, of course, because Canada has that say. I must also tell you today that Canada contributes probably around 12 to 14% of NORAD's assets. So our avaricious American neighbors have been good enough to allow us to continue to pose as if we are major contributors to NORAD, as we were 40 or 50 years ago, even though we're not now. But that's getting beside the point. The real point is, if we participate in the system, will we have some say? I would say if we don't have some say, then obviously we should not participate in the system, because the point I'm trying to make is participation in the system in itself is what we need to be aiming for. If we have to choose between 5% of a say and 0% of a say, I want us to have 5% of the say. And the way you have that is by being as much inside the tent as you can get. If you're not going to be in the tent one way or another, then there's no point in even trying to participate in it.
Glenn Fengstead, very much enjoyed your presentation.
See by your T-shirt.
Like that. I have a question. You didn't really touch much on the European aspect of this missile defense shield, and the fact, do you feel that with Germany, France, and England all looking now at protecting themselves from an Iranian ballistic missile, that it might make a easier sell for the Canadian populace?
Oh, I think the dynamic of actors that's going to work over the next
5 years to change Canadian public opinion. And why are the Europeans doing it? Well, partly they're doing it because of Iran, but another reason why they're doing it is because Iran is only the beginning of the tip of the iceberg of the proliferation of missile technology. We know that they're doing it because it's very much in their political interests to make sure that we know that they're developing long-range missiles. They're not trying to keep it any secret. But do we know, once they develop those missiles, once others, I mean North Korea, who knows what North Korea will do with the missiles that it develops? North Korea is a very poor country, hard up for foreign currency. Why not open up a Kmart for or a Walmart for long-range missiles? A man named A.Q. Khan, who was the father of the Pakistani nuclear program, and he ran his own Walmart for nuclear technology for a long time. So I think what the Europeans are saying is they're saying, well, right now Iran is the problem, but the future is undetermined. It's fuzzy out there. We don't know what it's going to look like 10 or 15 years from now. And if we start now to begin to think about developing a system, then maybe we'll be ready if such a threat develops. And if it never develops, okay. That's even better. I think you're going to see the same thing in Southeast Asia. The Japanese and the South Koreans and others will probably participate in the building of such a system. They've already announced that they're interested in it. Now you're getting to see, as I said, look it up on the Internet, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Bahrain, Qatar, etc. I mean, they're worried about the Iranians right on their doorstep. And I think eventually what we'll see is that a lot of Canadians will say, well, this is maybe an unfortunate reality, but it's a reality. So let's get with it. I think that's what will happen. I hope it'll happen.
My name is James Moore. preamble to my question, speaker's talking about looking things up on the Internet. Everyone in this room should go home at some point, look up on the Internet, Project for a New American Century. And there you'll see this presentation, but in a much clearer format, very similar to where you could look at the book Mein Kampf, written by Hitler, about his plans. And you can read it on the internet.
I will not be part of any discussion that brings in Hitler, Nazis, Mein Kampf. That's point one. Point two, I didn't come here to allow you to personally attack me. And number three, we've got a point to make. Make it without going over the top, okay?
No, I'm talking about the Project for a New American Century, which is on the Internet, which anyone can go have a look at, which is very, very clear about the plans and the point of the American dominant military power and to remain so in the new century. And within that plan, it's necessary to abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty, because you have to have some defense, and the Americans are making it very clear that they will have first strike capability with their nuclear weapons. They brought forward the idea of preemptive war and preventative war, where they've broken the international law on attacking other countries. They've made an example in Iraq, where you know, it was proven to be totally wrong, and you keep bringing up Iran.
What's your question?
The project for the new American century. This is, to me, what you're talking about. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it, and this PowerPoint demonstration is not a ripoff of the product for a new American century.
New American century you're talking about. This is another possibility. It's a Canadian possibility. Another world is possible than this one that you're talking about.
What is your question? You got a second question. Let's hear it.
This is the point of the dialogue.
Well, there's no dialogue.
Start off with Hitler and Nazis and the great Satan to the south, and I don't agree with you, so what's the point?
I can't dialogue
with people who believe in leprechauns. I'm sorry.
That's insulting as well, by the
way. Well, I was insulted before, so he's getting back in kind. And sir, you've got to turn up the microphone. Come right up and ask your question again.
Let's have the next question.
Okay?
My name's Ed Bardock. I always appreciate the articles you and your partner write. Where do you see the greatest threat of missiles in the world today? You've mentioned Iran, but is North Korea still at the forefront? Where do you see the biggest threat coming from?
The threat is that the countries that develop these technologies basically render themselves completely safe against the possibility of conventional military action taking place. And I think North Korea is a perfect example of it. Clearly, North Korea is one of the main reasons why this system is being developed today. And the move of North Korea to develop both weapons of mass destruction and long-range missiles is clearly part of that. And as I said, obviously, Iran is another one. We don't know what the others would be. I mean, who knows? Part of what used to be the Soviet Union moved towards democracy, liberalization, membership in the EU. Part of what used to be the satellite countries moved in that direction, the great majority of them, fortunately, but some didn't. Who knows where they will be in the future? Who knows what paths their foreign policy or defense policies will take? So it's hard to say. As I said, intelligence is not a perfect science.
Thank you. My name is John Boris. I'll admit, Mr. Berkerson, that you've gone up about 10% in my acceptance of, I cover your articles in the papers here, the chain, Calgary, Edmonton, like that. You talked about what we're faced with, and I think that's what we've got to, first of all, decide. Can you tell me what difference, if any, you think would have happened if the Americans had spoken the truth in Kuwait, in Iraq? Do you run around the world and tell them, you've got to do this, and then you find out that all these people are showing you as being useless? Could you have an observation on that?
Yeah.
They
won't accept for a response.
And I think if you're a big power, we let you build weapons, we can't do much about it. And I think we owe a damn apology from you.
Well, I totally agree with you. And I think there's a reason why George Bush is now floating around 28% approval rating in the United States. And that's part of it. For me, the most unfortunate, aside from the obvious destruction, the most unfortunate element that came out of that was the distrust with which now many people look at international intelligence. I mean, we just simply don't know what the hell is going on. And when we're being told, okay, this is the capability of X country, there's much more of a need today to pause and think, well, what actually is the reality? What is the evidence? How do we believe you today when we didn't believe you when we believed you then and we found out that this was wrong? And may I say, you know, it wasn't just the American intelligence agencies, it was the British and a lot of others. So, yeah, I mean, your point is very well taken, and I can't disagree with it.
Terry Shillington, thank you very much for being here. I'm really enjoying this debate and exchange of views. The first questioner asked one of my questions. My discomfort with this, I'd just like to offer a reflection and invite you to respond. My discomfort with this is captured when you say, well, if we're inside the tent, we'll have some say in this. If not, then we don't have any. And Canadians know who's inside the tent. You know, George and his friends are inside the tent, and it seems to us, if I could peer into the Canadian soul, that to link ourselves with American military defense strategies is to be part of their military strategies in response to the world, and we don't have a lot of confidence in American military and political wisdom, really, and it hasn't been demonstrated to be very wise. So would you care to comment on, I think that's at the heart of Canadian discomfort. Who's in the tent?
I mean, who's in the tent right now is, as you say, the president and his advisors. But we need to remember that missile defense was initiated under the Democrats and Clinton. Okay, that's very important. And when we talk about, quote, the Americans, unquote, I mean, who are we talking about? Are we talking about Bill Clinton, or are we talking about Senator Feinstein of California? Are we talking about Senator Leahy of Vermont? I mean, they've got a large and very complex political system, which is very much divided right now. People who want the United States to withdraw from Iraq immediately, senators, congresspeople, et cetera, et cetera, people who don't. So I think what we need to ask ourselves is this missile defense thing simply and only a result of the aggressive policies and the sort of unilateral tendencies that we saw emerging under the Bush administration, or is it something that is going to transcend politics in the United States? And in my opinion, as a non-fan of the President of the United States, it isn't going to matter who President of the United States is after George Bush is gone, because any President of the United States, Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, needs to look down the road at potential strategic threats to the United States, just as you look at the European countries today, NATO, you say, well, who are NATO's leaders? It includes the French. Mr. Chirac, who's against the war in Iraq, he wants to look at missile defense. The Spanish Prime Minister, who was elected and who withdrew Spanish troops from Iraq, he wants to look at missile defense. In Europe, there's a collection of countries today which are both on the left and on the right of the political spectrum, and they are interested in looking at missile defense. And why is that? Because politics comes and goes, but the technology continues to advance. And I think that's the way I think Canadians need to study this problem. Let's get away from our distaste of this president, who's probably even more unpopular in the United States today than he is in Canada, and think about this question in a larger perspective, from a larger perspective.
Name is Graham Greenlee. Just like to ask the question, what's wrong with being neutral? Like to hear a comment on that possible scenario.
Neutral? We can't be neutral. 80% of our trade goes to the United States. 45 cents of every dollar in your pocket is earned by trade with the United States. We are geographically contiguous with the United States. I'll go on and on and on and on and on. I don't know how realistic it is to think that you can saw off the country at the 49th parallel and float it out into the Pacific. If you could, we could be neutral. But I want to tell you that I think people should remember that neutral countries during the Cold War, and I'll name two of them, Sweden and Switzerland, spent far more on their defense budgets to maintain their neutrality than did Canada. So neutralism is a viable policy. But neutralism doesn't mean that it comes on the cheap. To be neutral in word and in deed, and to maintain your neutrality, and to say, as the Swedes, I'll use the Swedes as the best example, because they developed a very active and vigorous aerospace industry. If we're going to defend ourselves against all comers, we better have whatever it takes to do that. So whenever I hear people talk about Canada becoming neutral, I'm saying, okay, are you prepared to spend 5% of your GDP on defense, as opposed to the 1.2% we're spending now?
I have a quick question. Do you think this debate is going to go at the federal level now?
We've got a minority government that won a vote yesterday on further deployment in Afghanistan by five votes. It was four votes. This is not a government that's going to bring missile defense back to the table. And nor do they need to right now. But I think it will come back to the table at sooner or later, probably after the next election, if this government wins. If it's not this government, if it's a liberal government, it'll still face the question of missile defense. And if I may say, if it's a liberal government under Mr. Ignatieff, who seems to be the front runner, you will most certainly have missile defense back on the table, because Mr. Ignatieff on defense and international questions is kind of to the right of the Liberal Party, generally speaking.
My name is Leonard Hanrick. When the Cold War between Russia and the U.S. and let's say parts of Europe were was the big global issue, we were looking at the firing of a missile over thousands of miles, and it could be seen, intercepted, and perhaps something could be done, and the Russians sort of dropped off, as I understand it, because in the U.S. we had developed a decoy system that if they thought they were going to do something, we could send a whole bunch of essentially 40 missiles, not with warheads on there, but they would have to intercept all of that, and it would divert what they were doing. But in this short-range deal, we can't even spot them before they're actually hitting the ground somewhere. So it's a whole different issue. How can we cope with this sort of short-range rather than the long-range?
Well, actually, we are coping. The technology is there to cope with short-range. That's actually a misapprehension, a misunderstanding. The technology is there. The technology is almost there to protect armored vehicles against rocket-propelled grenades, and that's within a range of 500 meters. It's the long range that is the problem, not the short range. The long range, we've not had a technology developed by anybody. And although there have been some successes in this U.S.-based system that they've started to deploy, there have been as many failures. It's the short range that it's pretty well licked as a problem to those countries that can afford the defenses against it, but it's the long range that's the problem.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berkeson. We appreciate your comments, and you've been provocative, and that's exactly what Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs likes. And we want to just remind everybody that next week our speaker is Dave Hancock from the from Edmonton, potential candidate for the leadership of the Conservative Party, and he will be speaking on burning issues in Alberta. So with that, we thank you for coming today.